Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of On the Line. Today's guest is Lynn Enright. She is the author of Vagina, a Re-education. And if you follow me on any social media platforms, you'll know that I had a full-blown love affair with this book. I couldn't put it down. I took millions of photos of me reading it in the bathtub, on the beach, on my couch, everywhere. I absolutely cannot wait to have this discussion. So, Lynn, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And thank you so much for your very kind words and your support.
I mean, it's really true. I sent you a message on Instagram and I was talking to my assistant. I was like, I don't think she's going to want to come on the podcast. I was like, I'll just ask her. But I was like, you have to come on.
Oh, no, I'm delighted to be here. And I'm always keen to talk vaginas and vagina re-education. So.
I mean, this episode, when I put out the feelers and I told my audience that you were going to be on, I got such an amazing response. And I think one of those reasons is because it's still a taboo subject for some reason.
What's the deal? Yeah. I think I completely identify with what you're saying, and that I think it is a taboo. And then the fact that it is a taboo makes it really urgent to talk about, and people are really keen to talk about it once you start talking about it. And that's completely what I've realized since writing and publishing this book, that it was, you know, something that people feel they can't talk about. And so then when you do, there's a real push and a real eagerness. So I've had so many messages. I've had so much support. I've spoken about it more than I thought I would, you know, and it continues, because I think that there is a sense that we are really ready and ripe for this discussion right now.
Ready and ripe. Well, do you consider yourself a vagina expert, or how did this whole thing come about, this amazing book?
Well, no, I'm not an expert. I'm not a scientist. You know, I wasn't actually a health journalist, but I guess I had been writing about women and women's lives for certainly like 5 years. And I was working at a website called The Pool that no longer exists, but I had been a founding member of that, and I'd been head of news and content there. And so working there with a bunch of women and writing for a bunch of women and non-binary people had sort of meant that I felt quite clued in to the conversations that were happening and the conversations that were landing and were important to people. And I could see that when we did stuff about infertility, miscarriage, abortion, these sort of subjects that are considered taboo, there was a big response, because I felt that people weren't getting to have those discussions as much as they wanted to, whether that was in their real lives or hearing it in the media. So that was definitely one part of it. And then also I just got to thinking how those kind of bigger issues linked back to basic issues like women not knowing enough about their own anatomy. And the Eve Appeal and the gynecological cancer charity carried out research a couple of years ago that found that the average person, you know, around half of people, couldn't correctly identify a diagram of anatomy, of female anatomy. And so I kind of thought, well, you know, there's that problem happening. And there's the sense that we aren't open enough about infertility, abortion, miscarriage. Those subjects are connected. And then Me Too as well, you know, the Me Too movement. I was working at The Pool. It became a really important topic for us. And I felt that there were connections, again, to these like huge kind of societal problems and you know, these massive issues and thorny issues and complicated issues. But I still felt that they were connected in some way to the fact that the basic information about vaginas isn't there. So that's really what I wanted to do with this book, was kind of figure out why we don't have that information, what's happened in our history and our education that we haven't been given all the correct information about our vaginas, and then look at sort of filling in the gaps where that information isn't.
Absolutely. And I really wanted to talk about sex education later on in the podcast, but I just want to read a little blurb about your book for those people listening who maybe have never heard of it or are interested in it. And this is just a little blurb I read on Amazon. It says your book is about girls from their earliest childhood misled about their bodies, and they're encouraged to describe their genitalia with cute and silly names rather than anatomically correct terms. It confronts taboos such as abortion, miscarriage, infertility, and masturbation, and it also tackles vital social issues like period poverty, female genital mutilation, and the rights of transgender women. I really love that your book is so inclusive as well. I just wanted to point that out. So I guess let's just start with basics here. The word vagina and the word vulva, there's a difference.
Yeah. So I guess most of us, I mean, after we stop saying, you know, silly words like front bottom, or in my case, we used to say little bottom. But after we stop saying those, I guess we still continue to misname the area by calling it a vagina instead of a vulva. And I had always assumed that there wasn't really anything wrong with that, you know, that I thought, well, yeah, I know it's technically a vulva, but I call it a vagina and I don't think that matters. And then as I began to write the book, I realized actually it does matter. And there are feminists and philosophers and academics who have pointed this out before me. But, you know, if we call everything a vagina, we're sort of calling it all a hole, and, you know, a place where you menstruate, or a place where you can have penetrative sex, place where you can give birth, but you're ignoring the labia and the clitoris. And the clitoris is obviously where and how most women orgasm, certainly most powerfully and most easily.
The clitoris is the greatest thing ever.
Exactly, yeah. And when you think about the fact that we don't really say vulva, and we don't talk about clitorises that much, I think that we aren't hugely comfortable with the word vagina, but we're more comfortable with the word vagina than we are vulva and
yes.
clitoris. And those are kind of areas of, I think, female agency and female power that can be overlooked and diminished by not naming them. So I've got much more strict with myself about using the correct term. So vagina is the muscular tube. It runs from the vaginal opening up to the uterus, the cervix, and then the uterus. And then the vulva is sort of everything that you can see. So, you know, your pubic mound and your labia and your urethral opening, vaginal opening, and clitoris, you know, that's all the kind of vulva.
So if someone has a camel toe, that's the vulva.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't see your vagina. You really would have to go looking for a vagina. So if you say, I can see your vagina in those leggings, that's very unlikely.
Well, I guess another point I just want to bring up is, like, if you can't even say the word clit, how can you expect anyone else to talk about it or do the right things to it, et cetera? I mean, even when I just said it there, I was like, ooh, clit.
Yeah, I still have that. I think, you know, it's one of those words that has such weight. I remember as a child or a teenager sort of figuring that out. And I thought initially that it was slang, because you never hear it in any sort of like medical or educational context. Like, nobody tells you about your clitoris. I mean, maybe they do now, or it depends on what kind of home you grow up in. But I certainly had never really heard of my clitoris. So then when I started to hear the term, I assumed it was slang. And then even for years afterwards, I felt like I didn't really know it very well. And then even, you know, I was writing the book before I realized the full extent of the clitoris, that it extends inside the body.
Revolutionary to me when I read that.
I mean, and I feel kind of, you know, there have been women telling us this for decades. You know, this isn't new information in this book, but I think it was new information to me and a lot of other women, because even though there have been feminists educating us about our clitorises for decades and decades, the information doesn't stick, and it isn't made as widely known as it should be. So I feel like, you know, a really good example of that is that when you think about any of the diagrams that you see growing up about women's reproductive and sexual systems. So you'll see, you know, the one that everybody sort of knows is the vagina, the uterus, the fallopian tubes, and the ovaries. And I think most people know that one and recognize that, but you don't see the clitoris, the labia, the vaginal opening. You don't really see that diagram many places. You don't see the diagram of the clitoris, which you know is really integral to understand your own body, that you should be able to sort of see it. And we don't see it. And increasingly, I think there is a move to make people aware of what the clitoris looks like, so that, you know, there is that visible tip that you can see outside the body, but then it extends inside the body, and there's a shaft and there are legs and there are bulbs, and that's where, you know, that's where all those nerve endings are, and that's where all that pleasure is. And increasingly, I think there is a move to show people that. Some French schools are educating children with 3D models of the clitoris. And I just think that's really important, you know?
Yeah. Well, I guess for anyone listening who's like, well, what's the big deal? Like, who cares if we don't talk about it? I think this section in your book really kind of summed it up for me. It's on page 4. I just wanted to read it out now. It just talks about the sort of miseducation and how people don't really understand what's going on in their own bodies, like we were just saying. And it says that stigma leads to women foregoing orgasms because they have never been encouraged to seek them out. Stigma leads to women experiencing health problems because they're too embarrassed to talk to a doctor or a healthcare professional. Stigma leads to doctors failing to diagnose and treat endometriosis. Stigma leads to the president of the United States boasting about grabbing women by the pussy before cutting funding for family planning clinics and abortion providers. Stigma leads to the vagina and people with vagina being undervalued. And I think really that's what the fight is all about, you know? Of course, it's we need to know where it is, but it's more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, these basics of biology really extend right through every layer of society. And the fact that we are so sort of squeamish about our bodies does mean that we give up some of our power, I think. You know, I know that you know, we've known for years now that Donald Trump boasted about grabbing women by the pussy, but it's still sort of, you know, mind-blowing that he was recorded saying that, and that didn't have an impact on him becoming president. You know, it didn't matter. People didn't care in the end. And I suppose just to try and kind of unravel how we got into a position like that, you know, there are many, 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 many different reasons a situation like that comes about. But I do think that stigma plays its part.
Absolutely. So I guess sex education and teaching about it in schools is one of the first places that we can kind of tackle this. What's going on with sex education and what can be improved?
Well, I grew up in Ireland and I went to a Catholic state school, and my sex education was not good, but I had assumed when I started to write this book that the sex education I received was, you know, an anomaly. It was poor, but it was something that was in the past and perhaps something that wasn't widespread. But actually, as I researched the book, I realized that most people get a poor sex education. Mm-hmm. So people in the United States, generally, it's quite common to get a poor sex education, even a sort of deceitful sex education is quite common in the United States, actually.
That is something that's just so fascinating to me, and it's something that I can relate to a lot. I mean, when I think back to my one sex education class that I had, I was in grade 7. I might have been, I don't know, 12 or 13. It's really horrifying when you really think about it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are mistruths, downright lies in sex education. I had that. I think that the United States is quite bad for that. In the UK, I presumed that there was just a really sort of robust and good sex education. I don't know why I presumed that, but that was a misconception I had. But when I started to look into it, I realized that there are some schools and some teachers who do provide a really good sex education, but the standard throughout the UK is very, very patchy. They're just it isn't a sort of curriculum led, very clear area. Some teachers will have taken an interest, some schools will, some local councils will, but you know, in every school, there isn't a really good sex education. Now, there is a new curriculum on the way, which I think is good, is a good thing. And there are stipulations that mean that every school will have to do it. So at the moment, academies don't have to teach sex education. But when the new curriculum is brought in, every school will have to sign up. Sometimes parents will still be able to remove their children from classes, which I think, you know, is a bad thing. And also I've looked at the curriculum guidelines, and they're not really far reaching. It's not like, whoa, this is going to revolutionize everything.
Right.
Because I think there's still a fear that if you equip children with the facts, I don't know, I guess there's a fear that you'll sort of make them all like sex crazed. And that's just not what the evidence says, you know, because the Netherlands is the country that has probably the best sex education in the world. And they have, they teach, you know, they start it at a really young age, and 4-year-olds have, you know, relationships and sex education classes, but they're not, you know, they're not learning about sex, really. They're learning about relationships and the different relationships a person can have, and they're ending up, you know, safer. And then also there's evidence to suggest that people actually have sex later in the Netherlands, as sex education has become more robust. The age at which people lose their virginity has become older. So, you know, you're not encouraging people to have sex by telling them about their bodies and about possible relationships. You know, I just think you're making people safer, and you're also encouraging gender equality, because I think so much of the sex education so many of us received in Ireland, in the UK, in Europe, in the States, in all over the world has had gender inequality kind of sewn into it. I think because there's this, you know, essential fact that you get pregnant when you have heterosexual penis and vagina sex, and the man has an orgasm, and that's mm-hmm. how pregnancy occurs. And preventing pregnancy is very often an aim of sex education, that we've sort of put that, you know, at the center of sex education. And then we've often almost placed the responsibility on girls, mm-hmm. You know, that boys have this sort of really powerful sex drive, and it's almost like your job to manage that. That's certainly
right.
What a lot of people I know growing up felt.
Absolutely. I mean, just going back to your point about teaching 4-year-olds about relationships, etc. I mean, surely it's just amazing to even get those conversations going and being open, even about talking about friendship, relationships, all of those things. I mean, I learned about sex through basically my friends at school who were boning people when I wasn't. You know, it was really like that. Mm. And speak about miseducation. I mean, you learn the most random, weird, unhealthy things, you know? So I do think it's really important to teach it in school, as well as not everyone's parents are super comfortable talking about it. I never had one chat with my mom about sex.
Yeah, I had one, and she's, my mum is like is very open, very kind, forward-thinking in lots of ways person. But I guess it is, you know, it is awkward, or it certainly felt awkward when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s. And we did have one conversation. And I think that has been that has characterized sex education as well, that one conversation. So I had like one class in primary school, and it was like, well, now you're ready. Mm-hmm. And I had one chat with my mother. And actually, if you think about it, it's something that, you know, continues. It's a really big part of all of our lives, and kind of one half an hour isn't enough. And again, with the Dutch approach, with, you know, starting very young, you're having these conversations, but you're just as well sort of allowing for other conversations to take place, mm-hmm. and allowing for an openness, you know.
Do you think there ever will be a time where, you know, a lot of girls aren't embarrassed to talk about sex, and they'll really, you know, the majority of people will take ownership and be a part of the sexual revolution?
Yeah, I don't know. It would be interesting. I mean, I think that's just such a, yeah, it's a very big question. But I do see my friends who have kids now, and I see the way they talk to their little girls and boys, and I think that there is an increased openness. Now, that's like a very, that's like just anecdotal.
Right.
It's just people I know. But I have noticed that, and yeah. I do think that that is happening. Certainly, you know, I live in London, and so among 30-somethings in London, they seem to talk to their kids with more openness. You know, like, I don't know about the whole world. So I think that that will make a difference. I think that, you know, these discussions we are having about sex, about sexual abuse and sexual assault, about rape, I think that those conversations are around, and hopefully there will come a point where we can, where that makes a difference, I suppose. Because at the moment, I find it's very hard to know whether all the talking we have done about Me Too,
yeah,
let's say, has really made a difference. Because, you know, like we were saying, Donald Trump is still the president, and you know, he was just recently accused again by a woman of sexual assault, and you just, you know, so it doesn't actually seem to have made a difference. But then at the same time, I think that, you know, people are more aware, you know, certainly men I know, and parents I know, and you know, there is more awareness about consent, and then I suppose that we kind of, you know, it'd be really nice to then to get through to another point where we can talk about sex in a more joyous way again, yeah. You know, because I guess in the culture for the past few years, it's been quite bleak, really, a lot of the chat about sex.
Absolutely. I mean, just, you know, I spend my life on the internet. I've had my whole career on the internet. And I think for me, just noticing the different types of conversations that are going on now, even compared to 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, I totally understand your point of feeling like, is anything even changing because of all of this talking? And sometimes I feel the same thing. It's like, what are these tweets doing, you know? But exactly like you mentioned, when I come across different parents and I come across, you know, different guys I'm dating and stuff, it seems to have shifted something.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that the idea of sex positivity has sort of is getting increasingly mainstream. I feel like when I was growing up, women, and I already said this, but women were sort of, you know, thought to have to manage male sexuality. Mm-hmm. So sort of like that was this really powerful force. And girls and young women were sort of there to like manage that, to sort of, you know, try and get a boyfriend from that, or try and sort of, you know, string somebody along until, you know, all that kind of stuff was in our culture. Or like try, I mean, so many people I talked to left school like terrified of STDs and pregnancy, like,
yeah,
really, really terrified, like kind of to a quite an anxious degree. And actually, I think, you know, obviously it's really important that we learn about those things, but it's also important that we learn about what the clitoris is, and that there's this sense that sex can be a positive thing. And I think increasingly, I think you're right. I mean, again, I don't know, it's anecdotal, but I feel like in conversation, I feel like on Instagram, there is a sense of sex positivity.
Absolutely. I mean, sex is fun if it's consensual. Yeah. It really is. So I actually have a call-in question, and I'm hoping you can dispel one myth that I think a lot of people have. It's about vagina hygiene. So let's play the question.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Jen.
Okay.
Hi, Estee and Lynn. This is Rosa from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. My question for you is about hygiene down there. When I was growing up, my mom taught me to never use any kind of soap on the vagina, to not mess up the natural pH balance, etc. But now there seem to be more natural products on the market, and I honestly don't know the best way to keep everything fresh and clean and also healthy. I would love to hear your thoughts and experiences. Thank you. Bye.
I love this question so much, and it's something that I've been thinking about a lot, because when I was growing up, it was like, don't use anything. It's a self-cleaning oven. Mm-hmm. And exactly like the caller said, there's all these natural brands. Mm-hmm. And then I interviewed Marie from this probiotic beauty range, and she said, we need to balance the pH. What has your research shown?
Well, I mean, I guess it's confusing, because I think that, you know, again, it comes back to the vagina and the vulva. So like the vagina, yeah, I would say it is a self-cleaning oven. The vagina, but that is the bit inside you, right?
Right.
So that's the bit that you really kind of, you shouldn't clean, let's say.
And,
you know?
And that literally means stick your fingers up your vagina. Don't do that.
Don't do
with
that.
Soap.
Yeah, don't do that with soap. Don't do that with a douche. You know, that's a, we don't really use douches in the UK and Ireland. You can buy them in the supermarket or in a Boots or whatever. I don't know if you can get them in a Boots, but in a big pharmacy, let's say.
Yeah.
But they're quite rare. But then I remember going to the US when I was a teenager, going to, you know, like a Rite Aid or whatever, and just seeing like a huge aisle of vagina related products, including douches. And I did not grow up with those, but douches are bad pretty much. Anything that you can. Yeah, there's no need to ever kind of go to the vagina and to clean the vagina. There might be an issue, like you might have bacterial vaginosis or an STD, and you might notice a smell or a discharge. And in that case, yeah, you're going to have to do something about it. Probably antibiotics or medication, but still don't kind of take it upon yourself to go up there. You should probably, you know, go to a doctor or a sexual health clinic. Mm-hmm. And then the vulva, well, I kind of treat the vulva like normal skin, but like sensitive skin, right? Because it's like mucous membrane and sensitive skin. So I think, you know, you can wash that, but then you also need to realize that, you know, it will smell sometimes. And I think that, you know, that's just normal. Like vulvas do smell.
Yes.
And that's not something to be ashamed about, you know. And if it's really hot, it will smell differently. If you've been exercising, it will smell differently. If you've had sex, it might smell differently. If it smells really unusual or really bad, then you go to the doctor.
Right.
But that's kind of, I think that there's so much anxiety about washing, because we've been taught to be ashamed, mm-hmm. ashamed of it ever smelling, ashamed of what it looks like. And then I think there is increasingly a market of sort of vagina and vulva beauty products. Really.
Yes, I've been noticing this.
Yeah. And in a way, I think there's something positive about the fact that, you know, you can go on like a quite chic beauty website now and see products that are for vaginas and vulvas. And you know, I think, you know, it's nice to see those words in these spaces. And yet, you know, mainly they're products that people don't need.
Right.
And it's just a little bit concerning when there isn't a clear need for a product, traditionally what happens is people create that need mm-hmm. by making people feel insecure.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that's kind of my take on vagina.
Well, I think that's the most clear answer I've ever got out of someone on this subject. And I agree wholeheartedly with you. Okay, so kind of going back a little bit to anatomy, I really need to talk about the hymen.
Mm.
Page 34, guys. There are diagrams. Speaking of fear around sex, of fear of getting STDs, fear of getting pregnant, fear of breaking my hymen was like the most terrifying thing to me at age whatever, 11, 12, whatever it was. I was so terrified, and I I didn't know what to expect. I don't even remember ever breaking it, though. So let's talk about the hymen.
Yeah. Well, I think that for a lot of people, they grow up with the idea that a hymen is like a sort of seal of their vagina. And so, you know, it exists really clearly as a seal that everybody has, and it's broken the first time you have sex, unless you break it before with a tampon or with like horse riding or something.
Literally, I remember like going for bike rides and thinking, oh my God, I could break my hymen today.
Yeah. And actually, you know, that idea is pretty false. The hymen there does exist, but it differs from girl to girl and woman to woman. So some people will have quite a kind of visible hymen, and some people will be born or certainly will reach puberty without having a hymen, or it might just kind of fade away. You know, it's just a piece of sort of mucous membrane, and so it can really differ from person to person. It's not this seal. It's not proof of virginity, and you know, some people will bleed the first time they have sex, and some people won't, and there's no difference between those except for the way that their body is. Mm-hmm. And hymens are different from person to person, and you know, I think because it doesn't really have a biological function, it's quite different from person to person. It's quite mysterious in a way. And then the hymen has become more like a symbol, and a symbol of purity and virginity, and women's purity and women's virginity. And I think it's been incredibly unhelpful and continues to be incredibly unhelpful. You know, there are especially some cultures, Arab culture places a lot of emphasis on the hymen, and women who have had sex before or who don't have a hymen will face problems and discrimination and even violence if they don't bleed on their wedding night.
Yeah, that was a really interesting part of the book, actually. So I actually have a question that I was really interested to hear about. And I think that speaking of, you know, hymens and everything else, it's like we need to speak more about different women's experiences. So I just wanted to play this next question for you.
Hey, Estee. My name is Rowan and I live in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I'm so glad you're talking about vaginas and women's health today, because I have a condition that's called vulvodynia, and it's something I'd never heard of and my friends had never heard of, but I'm still learning about it and I'd love to raise awareness about it. So vulvodynia is basically a chronic pain condition that affects the entrance to the vagina. And I'm pretty sure I've had this my whole life, because I remember the first time I ever tried to use a tampon, and my friends telling me that it hurts maybe the first time, but you get the hang of it and to relax and all these things. But I've always found it to be incredibly painful, and just impossible at times. I've been to the gynecologist, and thankfully they'd heard of this condition and were the ones that diagnosed me with it. They've since prescribed me with two different topical treatments that, when I used them, only aggravated the area more and actually caused me quite a bit of pain for a couple of days after using the treatments. So I guess what I want to know is if Lynn has ever heard of this condition, and if she has any advice or treatment options or things that I should try. And I'd also just love to hear you guys talk about this and see if you've known anyone or have experienced pain in your vagina before. It's pretty terrible, and no one talks about it, so that's why I'm here. Anyways, love the podcast, and thank you so much. Have a good one.
Yeah, I mean, I personally don't have personal experience with vulvodynia, but I did speak to people who do for the book, and it is quite common, and it can make, you know, like the woman said, using a tampon really painful, but sex can be really painful, feel sort of impossible, even sitting down, you know, and it can feel excruciating.
What is it really?
It's quite mysterious. And the problem is that the research just isn't there and hasn't been done, and it has been a taboo as well, and something that has been passed off and minimized. And so it's quite mysterious. Like, doctors don't 100% agree on what it is. Mm-hmm. The treatment options that aren't very clear. So, you know, like that caller said, her doctors did take it seriously, but then the treatment she was prescribed actually exacerbated the situation or seemed to make it worse. So it's not clear. And there is, I think, because there is stigma surrounding the vulva, there's stigma surrounding conditions affecting the vulva. Mm-hmm. I spoke to a woman for the book who had found that she had gone to physiotherapy, to a physiotherapist who specialized in this area, and that had helped, and sort of stretching the tissue with a wand almost actually internally had helped her vulvodynia. Mm-hmm. I know somebody else who was prescribed antidepressants. There's a particular antidepressant that you can use in a low dose that will help with vulvodynia.
Wow.
But it is an area that needs so much more research.
Right.
So much during this book, it was just like more research is needed.
Yeah.
You know, this women's health has been overlooked, and then when you get into it, you realize that, you know, women of color's health, even worse, you know, the mortality rates for black pregnant women in America, you know, is so much worse than white pregnant women. So you realize that there's just these kind of layers of neglect with women's health, and vulvodynia is one of those. I think as well, there's this sense with women and vaginas that women's bodies are painful and women's vaginas are painful. So, right. You know, we get periods and that's really painful, and you're just told, well, you know, that's life. And obviously you can take painkillers, you can take the contraceptive pill, and those things might help. But essentially it's like a monthly pain, and that's something that you have to live with. Pregnancy and, well, childbirth is excruciating, and that's kind of the reality. And sex often, you know, there's a sort of writing off of sex as painful. And I think even in sex education, even talking about hymens, there's this sense that, you know, well, yeah, it will hurt. And we don't really talk enough about why it will hurt and how to make it less painful, you know, instead of just saying to young women, yeah, sex the first time is really painful, we should be talking to them about how it's less painful if you're really aroused, or it's less painful perhaps if you use a lubricant, you know. But we don't, we just kind of just accept that there's this sort of fundamental pain to the vagina and the vulva. And then when we do that, we sort of overlook really serious conditions like vulvodynia, you know, similarly endometriosis.
Yeah, can we speak about that? I mean, I have a few friends who have it, and I remember them saying that, you know, they were experiencing all this pain and problems, and they went to the doctor, and it was a very similar situation. The doctor just basically saying, well, yeah, that's going to hurt, you know, that sort of thing. So how do you know when it's not just like, you know, the pain that we're used to feeling versus something really,
yeah,
you know, worth talking to a doctor about?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard. And I think that it's really hard to sort of know when to go to the doctor if you've been told all your life that periods are really painful and you will feel terrible. I suppose if you sort of notice any changes, that's always go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose also, I hate to have to say it, but I think sort of take notes and make a case. I think that sometimes I know that I've done this, that I get quite flustered that the doctors are sort of just trust them. And you know, in the UK, I love the NHS and I really respect it. Obviously, it's under great strain. And then you go to the doctor and you realise, you know, you only have a very short amount of time, and it can feel like quite a rushed, intimidating, yeah, environment. And then, you know, I think that a lot of us grow up with great respect for doctors, and I still have great respect for doctors, but that can mean that you're, you know, you feel cowed or intimidated. So I think, you know, take notes and sort of make notes, write down the dates that you experience this pain, sort of go in with a very clear idea, not of what you want because they are the expert, but a very clear idea of what you want to say mm-hmm. and what you want to tell them. You know, endometriosis, people have suffered with it for years, usually before they get a diagnosis. And then often because it's, you know, it's happening inside their bodies and it can have really, really grave consequences. You know, organs can become fused and people can become infertile and people, you know, obviously can experience incredibly excruciating chronic pain. Mm-hmm. And so it's really an incredibly serious condition that we need to, again, there needs to be more awareness of mm-hmm. and doctors need to kind of step up a little bit mm-hmm. with it too.
I mean, there's also PCOS, which mm. One of my best friends was telling me that she has. You know, it's like all of these things, going back to sex education, it was never discussed. These are all things that I learned about in my mid-20s.
Yeah, yeah, that is true, actually. Yeah, I think that we're sort of a little bit not filled in on our own health and our own bodies. And I think, you know, there are reasons, like these are conditions that are quite difficult to diagnose, and I accept that. But it does also feel that there's kind of a sense that they don't really matter. You know, I'm accessing fertility treatment at the moment, and I had gone to the doctor for years with symptoms of fibroids and PCOS, and neither of those things were taken particularly seriously until now. I'm accessing fertility treatment and I will be having IVF, and then they kind of take it very seriously because it might affect the outcome of that treatment.
Right.
But they didn't take it seriously really in any way when I just said I'm in pain or my periods are irregular or I have adult acne, or, you know, with the fibroids, it was like I have these incredibly excruciating, long, painful periods like this. I can't have that. And it had changed. And it just, I have to say, it wasn't taken particularly seriously. But mm-hmm. now they're taking it seriously because it might impact the result of IVF, which is a very expensive process, mm-hmm. that, you know. So I think that we need to have probably better healthcare for vaginas, vulvas and our reproductive systems that isn't necessarily to do with pregnancy mm-hmm. or fertility.
Right.
That's about just kind of women's health and women's comfort.
Well, I don't remember the exact quote, but something that I had never thought about and you said you hadn't particularly thought about it was, you know, your whole life you think about preventing pregnancy mm. and then you come to a point where you think you're just going to get pregnant mm. and speaking on that subject was really interesting to me because I've never thought about how I'm going to get pregnant in my life.
Yeah, I think it's like you're sort of told, like, don't get pregnant, get pregnant, why aren't you pregnant?
Yeah.
That's what it feels like as a woman. And so I think, you know, necessarily we are taught about preventing pregnancy when we're young, and that's a real priority. And then there hasn't probably been enough discussion about getting pregnant. And even people I know who have had kids and haven't needed fertility treatment, but they've still been really shocked by the fact that you don't get pregnant, you know, necessarily probability, you don't get pregnant the first time you have unprotected sex, that it usually takes a bit longer, especially as you get older.
Right.
So, you know, because we sort of talk to teenagers, because teenagers and people in their early 20s are more fertile. And all of these discussions are really difficult to have, I suppose, about fertility, because I feel like there's so many different reasons why a woman might not become a mother in her 20s, 30s, you know, why she might wait, and they're to do with money and the housing market. You know, it feels pretty impossible for most millennials to get a house. And so, you know, you sort of feel like you probably do need a house or at least a 2-bedroom apartment to be in a position to have a child. You know, the cost of childcare, all of that. And so we need to, it's very difficult to talk about because there are so many different reasons. And then And then, you know, there is this sense that you may have left it too late. And that feels like a really horrible burden that a woman bears compared to a man. Because as well, we don't really talk about male infertility very much, you know, in our culture and our society, when actually 50% of non-age related infertility is to do with male infertility.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So we're just not really set up to talk about that. And I think, you see, if a couple is experiencing male factor infertility, they will have IVF or a certain kind of procedure of IVF called ICSI. And that happens in the woman's body, really. You know, so it kind of comes back, the way we treat male factor infertility comes back to the woman and the egg and IVF, really. So we're sort of, it's easily glossed over, male factor infertility. And you know, I'm not saying that to try and kind of make men feel bad that they too can be infertile, but just to sort of try and open up these honest conversations, because I think that can really help people. Because, you know, couples experiencing infertility can feel really alone and like it's only, you know, happened to them, when actually it's like 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 couples experience this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Honest conversations. I mean, what a concept.
Yeah.
Just really speaking honestly. So switching pace a little bit, I want to talk about the joys of sex. Mm-hmm. Actually, let me go back to the subject of labioplasty before we get into to that. I just wanted to touch on that because I got a lot of questions written in about women saying that they were embarrassed by the way their vulva looked and that they were, you know, too shy to have sex because they didn't necessarily look like they thought a vulva should look. So what is labioplasty and what's your opinion on it?
Labioplasty, so surgery to kind of resize or reshape the labia, usually the inner labia, is the fastest growing type of plastic surgery in the world.
Wow.
Now, that doesn't mean that it's really, really commonplace, but it does mean that it's growing at a fast rate. So people are increasingly getting it. I find that really depressing, mm-hmm. I must say, because yes, it is sometimes necessary, and some women who have it might have a very good reason for it, that, you know, their inner labia are much, much longer and they find like sports painful or running painful or sex painful, and they might make that decision for themselves and their own body.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people who are getting labioplasty, and young women especially, are doing it because they feel like their labia don't look a certain way. You know, their labia are asymmetrical. So one inner labia is longer than the other, one side is longer than the other. But that is so standard. Like, that is like very few people have these kind of labia where the inner labia sits really neatly inside mm-hmm. the outer labia and everything just looks really symmetrical. Like, that's really rare. But, you know, I guess one of the problems is that we don't really talk about vulvas. We don't really see vulvas. Like I said, we don't have very many diagrams of vulvas. So then when young people see mainstream porn and they see the vulvas of mainstream porn, they're seeing vulvas that have likely had labioplasty. So those porn performers probably have had labioplasty, or they've been chosen to be porn performers because their labia are like super photogenic or whatever, you know. And so then young people are seeing those labia and thinking that that's what all labia look like.
Yeah. And I mean, imagine watching porn as, you know, a teenager and not seeing yourself represented in that way. I mean, of course you're going to get self-conscious about it.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's another reason that sex education really needs to sort of step up here, because kids do have access to porn. You know, we can't pretend that they don't. And whatever your views are on porn, you know, I don't think that porn is necessarily an evil thing, but I do think I do think it's unhelpful and unhealthy for young people to see porn without having any sort of sense of the reality of bodies and of sex. And so I think that we need to educate kids.
Absolutely.
And we need to protect kids as well, you know. So I think that should be a priority. I think there's so many issues that, come from the kind of widespread internet porn, but one of them, yeah, is letting girls know that the labia they see in porn isn't kind of the standard labia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I could do a whole podcast just on porn. It's such a vast subject. Mm. But let's switch pace a little bit to the joys of sex. Mm-hmm. Speaking of porn, let's talk about masturbation. Mm-hmm. I loved when you spoke about masturbation in the book, and it brought back a lot of memories for me talking about the boys at school talking about, like, jerking off and all this stuff, and the girls never spoke about it. Girls don't masturbate. Mm. No, of course we don't masturbate because we don't get pleasure from sex. Mm. Like, that, remember that actually happening. So let's talk about masturbation, first of all, because I still meet people in my 30s. Well, I'm 29 almost. I mean, friends who are in their 30s who have never masturbated.
Wow. Yeah.
That's my reaction. Yeah. Wow.
Mm. No, I think, you know, they're probably in a minority, but yeah, they exist because, you know, I think that it's really powerful for us all to grow up in a culture that tells us that we shouldn't and that we don't. You know, I think there is a big lie about it. I think that absolutely it is the case that girls grow up thinking that boys masturbate, and there's this idea, you know, in our culture that oh, it's, we're a little bit squeamish about it, but it's sort of funny that we think, you know, teenage boys turn into these, like, masturbating kind of, like, gross little boys for a couple of years, and girls, we just that's much more taboo,
right?
Which, you know, is so weird when you think about it.
It really is peculiar.
Yeah. And then I guess I grew up thinking, you know, that nobody I knew talked about it. The sex education books didn't talk about it. I remember a sex education book that talked about wet dreams for boys. And so I thought that, you know, boys woke up every morning like having these like really sexy dreams. And it never talked about how girls also have sexy dreams, you know.
They're rare, though, for me, yeah. Sadly.
And so that was a real shock when I realized girls could have sexy dreams too. But I think it's back down to a fear of female sexuality that we mm-hmm. just kind of don't allow people to own that, and that we're very, very, very squeamish about girls.
We are.
Girls masturbating.
I mean, I remember, I think it might have even been my stepmom who was like, just take a hand mirror and look at your own vagina. She meant vulva.
Yeah.
And I remember doing it and thinking, this is so embarrassing. And it's attached to me. It's me, you know? Why is it? And I think it's a similar situation with masturbating for a lot of people. It's like, there's this, it is shame.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's shame. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. Yeah. And, you know, I think that some of that exists, probably it depends on the individual. It depends on the, you know, obviously on the individual circumstances, but, you know, maybe something even more individual, like the person they are and the way they interact with their body. And then also, you know, I think some people find it really easy to orgasm, okay? So
right.
I think some people will grow up and they'll find a way of masturbating that works for them at a very young age, and some women won't. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are differences, you know, both in psyche and literally in the biology, which means that everybody's different, and some people will derive lots of pleasure from it, some people won't. But I think what can be said to be true for almost everyone is that there is a squeamishness in the culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of orgasms, what are the different types of female orgasm?
Well, I guess what I feel like, it isn't particularly helpful to even divide them into types, because there has been a sense in the past to decide whether something is a clitoral orgasm or a vaginal orgasm or a blended orgasm, which is both clitoral and vaginal. And then once you start to sort of categorize them, there's been like a pecking order that, you know, vaginal orgasm, that's the best one because, you know, you can get there via penis and vagina sex, and then, you know, it can be like a movie where you and your partner come at exactly the same time. Whereas clitoral orgasm, where, you know, you kind of might have sex and then you might, you know, touch yourself or your partner might touch you, or you might use the vibrator, that's kind of seen almost like cheating. And you know, that's just really stupid. And I think that, you know, we should be, if you have a good orgasm, you should be happy to have a good orgasm. And it doesn't matter whether it like derived from like a particular part of your anatomy. And anyway, increasingly, you know, we sort of realize how the clitoris extends inside the body and how
it... Can we talk about that like in actual detail? Yeah. I couldn't believe my eyes what I was reading about the clitoris.
Yeah. So basically, like, when an embryo is in utero for the first few weeks, it's male or female kind of is the same, and they have the same sort of genitals, and then one bit develops in male babies develops into the penis, and then in female babies generally develops into the clitoris. And so that's kind of the basics. And actually, the clitoris is, you know, because the penis is outside the body, but the clitoris is mostly inside the body. But there is a shaft of the clitoris, which we don't see, but which is inside the body. And then there are these kind of legs which extend into the body, and they grow larger when you're aroused. And then there are these bulbs. And so they sort of surround the vagina. And so let's say, you know, it depends on people's individual anatomies. But for most people, you know, if you're having a good time and you're having penetrative sex and you're feeling sensation in your vagina, it's quite likely that it's the kind of inner part of the clitoris that you're actually sort of engaging with there. So yeah, it's very complicated. It's also, you know, the data isn't there, that all the research isn't there. Orgasms remain sort of mysterious, you know, it isn't 100% clear what's happening in the body and the brain at every given time. An orgasm, you know, what exactly is an orgasm yet? Like, there might be sensations and pulsing in the genitals, you might be able to track those, but that isn't necessarily the orgasm, because some people will have an orgasm and report an orgasm without having those. So it's very difficult to say definitively what exactly scientifically an orgasm is, where exactly it happens. So really the best thing that you can go for is, you know, just sort of hope that you have an orgasm, and one that's good, and be pleased that that happens, and that, you know, whether you're on your own or with a partner, that, you know, that happens and it's good. That's what matters.
It is good. It can't sleep, have an orgasm. That's all I got to say, guys. It's the best thing. So I was not going to do this podcast without mentioning squirting.
Oh, okay.
And I have one last caller for you, and she was obviously on the same wavelength as I was, so I'm going to play the question.
Hi, Este. Thank you for introducing me to this book. I'm really excited to read it. And thank you, Lynn, for taking my question. My question is, why do women squirt? The information that I can find online seems to always be centered around what is squirt, like is it pee or not, which I guess is a valid question, but there's nothing that I can find about why women do it to begin with. What is the biological reason behind it? Why do some women do it and other women don't? What's the deal there? Thank you.
I love this question.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that's like one of the things that kind of keeps coming up. I don't know, and people don't know. And also kind of the biological reason. And actually, you know, a lot of the time with stuff, there isn't a biological reason for stuff. Like, why do women orgasm? We don't know. There is no biological reason for that. Why does the hymen exist? There is no biological reason for that. And so I think that when there isn't a clear biological reason for something, people can start to like read into its meaning and use it as a symbol almost. And sort
right.
So I don't think that there is a clear biological reason for squirting. I think that, yeah, as the caller said, there's loads of discussion and debate about whether it's pee or not. And I would say it depends as well. Like a small amount is usually not pee. It's a fluid created in a gland. But I suppose it's become this very... it's almost like a measurable thing, and that's why it's become a porn
its own category.
Yeah, its own category. Yeah. So because it's a really visual way of kind of saying, yeah, I came, or yeah, I enjoyed that. So because it's very visual, it's become very common in porn. Whereas actually, you know, it's probably not. It's not that common, but yes, some women do it, and it's not, we're not quite sure why, we're not 100% sure what's in it, and it's just kind of a normal part of our bodies that's become fetishized in some way. Right?
Is it pleasurable?
I think some women do it when they orgasm, so I don't know that the exact moment of squirting is pleasurable, but it has come about because they have experienced pleasure, and because perhaps they have relaxed, or that part of their body has, you know, something has happened in that part of their body.
Right.
But it is quite mysterious, and I don't have all the answers.
Mysterious is the word for it. That is for sure. Well, you know, this subject, there's just so much to talk about. I wish I could talk to you for another 2 million hours, but the studio will charge me double. Was there anything in this, you know, during this time of you writing this book that you were like, I really wish I could put this in the book, but you just couldn't fit in?
Not sure. I think that, you know, as I've said loads of times, you know, I don't know everything about squirting. I don't know everything about the orgasm. I don't know everything about vulvodynia. And yeah, I'm not an expert, but still there are people who are experts who don't know. You know, a lot of it is mysterious. And in some ways that's kind of interesting, but in some ways it can mean that, you know, people suffer with pain or bad sex or, you know, problems that they shouldn't have to, because there just isn't enough research, data, you know, there isn't enough done to make life better for vaginas and vulvas. So that's what I wish would happen.
Mm. Are there any other books on this subject that you recommend or that you read while doing your research that you thought, ooh?
Yeah, there's a reading list at the back. There's a great graphic book. It's like, you know, like a comic book called The Vulva Versus the Patriarchy. It's, I think she's Swedish. She's definitely Scandinavian. That's really good. There's an English translation. Nimco Ali has a book coming out about vaginas. I think it's out this week. So it's out June 27th, I think. And she has done amazing anti-FGM work, so I'm really, really pleased to see her book coming out. There's a whole load of vagina books coming out, actually, which is incredibly brilliant. You know, I think that we are sort of living through a bit of a vagina moment. You know, maybe 2019 has been the year of the vagina, and I couldn't be more thrilled to be part of this.
Absolutely. Well, it has been so fascinating talking to you. And to those of you listening, no matter how much you think you know about vaginas, vulvas, and clitorises, I can guarantee you will still be surprised by things in this book, and you will find yourself nodding along with so many things. I cannot recommend this book enough. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where can people find you if they want to follow you?
I'm on Instagram, Lynn Enright, Twitter, Lynn Enright. Yeah, that's it really. But yes,
lovely.
I'm there.
Thank you so much.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.